Rob E. Cheryl Zachar, Yuri Appellant Counsel, Matthew W. E. Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Craig Brodsky, and I represent your appellant, Mark. This case is about whether a client who was aggrieved by his lawyer's mistakes after he filed his petition for bankruptcy, leading to a denial of discharge in bankruptcy, should have been able to get into court and have his claim decided by a jury. The answer to this question is yes. The Circuit Court for the City of Alexandria made three mistakes. Its first mistake was when it denied him standing. Its second mistake was when it denied him the right to have the plea decided by a jury. Its third mistake was when it denied him the right to amend. These are our three assignments of error. And we're asking this Court to find that Mr. Ladwell had standing and to remand this case for the City of Alexandria for trial on the merits.
May I ask you this? Can you take a list of post-petition allegations of separate causes of action and tell us exactly which ones of those bullet points involve a new, separate, different act of negligence and a new, separate, different damage associated with the new, separate act of negligence? Because otherwise, the first negligence, the pre-petition or petition negligence, everything else is going to be damages, and you will lose that argument. So what is it about your list that takes us out of that general proposition?
Certainly. Under Virginia law, new and distinct damages from new and distinct wrongful acts is a separate cause of action.
No, that can't possibly be true. You have a cause of action that creates some damage, and it doesn't matter that future damage hasn't occurred yet. If there was a duty, a breach, and some damage, your cause of action accrues like that. And if the damage occurs 5,000 years later, you don't get another shot at it. You've got to have a new tort in order to have a new cause of action, which requires a new act of negligence.
I think we're talking about the same thing, Your Honor, which is, and Ms. Reagan-Hart concedes this, and we talk about this in our brief in the Hampton Roads case and the cases that follow the Hampton Roads case. And I'd be happy to talk about Ms. Reagan-Hart's post-petition actions. And it's our position in this case that the reason that Mr. Ladwell was denied his discharge is because of the post-petition acts and the specific wrongful acts. These are listed in on page 65 to 70 of the appendix.
If you want to go through that list.
And that list begins with how she spoke with and responded to Mr. Ladwell after the 341 hearing, when the trustee asked for a copy of the deed. It continued into September. That was in August of 2013. It continued into September of 2013, when the trustee told Mr. Ladwell that he wanted to come into his house to see whether or not he could do a market analysis to determine the value of the property. Then, later in October of 2013, the Chapter 7 trustee filed an objection to the claimed homestead exemption.
But their argument is that those kinds of things are just the kind of fallout things that happen from the initial negligence, which is filing the petition and not advising the client exactly what the consequences were of the tenancy by the entirety deal that they pulled off, which on the face of it, I would think, would be something that would be discussed in theory.
I understand.
So you're just repeating the consequences of that, and their argument is, yeah, that's the same initial cause of action. So where's the new negligence?
The new negligence was specifically how she gave Dr. Ladwell the advice about responding to the trustee. Our expert report, and we put this through together, and I think a jury needs to decide this, and I'll get into it, is our position under the pleadings and the evidence in this case is that the post-petition negligence led to the filing of the 727 adversary complaint. The 727 adversary complaint to deny discharge was not filed until after Mr. Ladwell had a 2004 examination in January of 2014.
All those lowball offers, allowing that, participating in that, encouraging it, is your argument that there's a brand new tort there, and the trustee's later adversary proceeding was natural consequence of being jerked around during negotiations.
That's our position, and at a minimum, and this is our second assignment of error, at a minimum, that issue should have been presented to a jury. We think as a matter of law, he has standing for those claims under the new and distinct wrong causing new and distinct causes of action. But at a minimum, that should come into the jury, because remember, it's a six-month period of time. In October, the trustee files the objection.
So can I ask you another question?
Sure.
How would this work out if that's true? Let's suppose the failure to properly navigate the negotiations in the hearing and it leads to everything blowing up in the adversarial process. Let's suppose it's a new separate tort and a new cause of action with new damage. You'd go to a fact finder and you would get a standing of instruction that says, look, you don't concern yourself with any of the negligence that preceded the petition. We're only talking about negligence after the petition. You're okay with that, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Right. Because the denial of discharge is the major harm that was suffered by Mr. Labgold. It left him with $1 million in expenses and debts associated with it. It completely obfuscated, and just there's no reason to file a bankruptcy, as Mr. Henry stated in his expert report. It's the sine qua non of a bankruptcy. I mean, if you want to file for bankruptcy, you want a discharge. So a bankruptcy lawyer, in our opinion, has a duty to be alert for the potential for a 727 action. Ms. Reagenhart dropped that ball repeatedly, and had she been on her toes and complied with the standard of care, according to our allegations, then Mr. Labgold would not have been denied a discharge. And I want to point out for Your Honor that part of the issue is, remember, in this case, it was in December of 2014. She gets a draft copy of a complaint to vitiate the homestead exemption. And she tells him to offer $30,000 in response to a demand for $221,000. That demand gets reduced to about $200,000. 6 weeks later, after the 2004 examination, she says, oh, offer $125,000. And so that's what led to the denial of discharge.
But we would not, if you're right, this court would not have to decide whether or not the post-petition negligence theories could be successful. Because the only issue that's been decided at this point is not does the cause of action have viable legs to go forward, and there's no material difference of opinion of fact, but whether or not it's pre or post.
I think I understand your question, which is you're just here to look at standing and not to the merits of this case, and I agree.
Even to the point where we don't have to, under my understanding of your theory of the case, we don't have to identify the breach in the negotiation period as a viable legal breach. I mean, a judge may say there's no genuine issue material fact on that, and that's a whole different issue than standing, right?
I think that I understand your question, and yes, that's for a later time. That's not the issue before this court, if I'm understanding Your Honor's question correctly.
You just need to plead a prima facie, theoretical, post-petition new tort.
That's my opinion, and I believe that our amended complaint, which we did not get the opportunity to amend and file, at a minimum, we should have been able to do so. Because Rule 1:8 addresses this issue perfectly. Leave to amend should be liberally granted to achieve the ends of justice. So unless there's bad faith or dilatory conduct, we should have the opportunity to amend. It's an abuse of discretion for a circuit court to use the wrong legal standard or make an error of law. And it's routinely granted in this court and in the trial court that motions to amend are allowed to clean up and amplify pleadings. And all we need to show, and this goes to Your Honor's question, is a viable theory of post-petition negligence. That post-petition negligence has been recognized throughout Virginia. It's inconsistent. It is consistent with Virginia law. It's consistent with other legal malpractice cases involving denial of discharge. And that post-petition negligence is a viable cause of action for Mr. Lavold. I should have said this at the beginning. I was hoping to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I apologize. So if I've waived that, I understand, Your Honor.
No, you haven't waived it. You have 5 minutes left.
So we would urge this court to give Dr. Lavold the opportunity, at a minimum, to go to a jury and say, did the post-petition malpractice cause Dr. Lavold to lose his discharge?
Counsel, what was the basis that the bankruptcy court gave for not discharging the debt? I couldn't find that order in the JA.
Okay. The appendix does have Judge Kenney's order, and Judge Kenney went through the standard analysis of the badges of fraud under the 727.
Where in the JA is that? Oh, you can go ahead with your answer. You can go ahead with your answer and just find it for me.
Yes, I'd be happy to. Judge Kenney went through the badges of fraud and concluded that Mr. Lavold should be denied his discharge based on those particular findings. But those findings...
Did he specifically say based on the filing of the petition? It seems that Judge Tranga said that the discharge was based on the filing of the petition.
It was based on
the
acts
of the discharge.
Before the filing of the petition.
So if the court concluded that was the basis for not granting the discharge, how then would you go to a jury and say, fine, that the court decided it on some other basis?
This is a good question, Your Honor, and I think the issue ties into Ms. Reagan-Hart's collateral estoppel argument. Collateral estoppel goes to the causation. It's not before this court. It's not our call. It's in any assignment of error. It's a question of the preclusive effect of Judge Kenney's findings. Judge Kenney's findings are not collateral estoppel in this case for several reasons. First, it
goes... basis for its ruling as to why it did not grant the discharge?
But we should be able to argue, yes, because we were not, Ms. Reagan-Hart was not a party. First of all, for collateral estoppel to apply, you have to have the same parties. Assuming, we're dealing, though, with the issue of causation. And Your Honor has raised tough questions that are going to have to be addressed later in this case. But that's a causation issue, not a standing issue.
Your whole theory is if the lawyer had done the lawyer's job right, no one would have really found out about the alleged trickery, and the trustee wouldn't have filed the adversary proceeding, and the bankruptcy judge wouldn't have issued an order saying, yeah, you were just trying to hinder your creditors.
Don't like how you phrase that, Your Honor. I think the way that I would phrase it is that had Ms. Reagan-Hart turned to Mr. Lavold and said, this transfer is a problem. Just pay $200,000, get your house back. Let's see what happens. That should go to a jury.
Well, whether it goes to a jury or not, it still filters between here and the jury. That someone's got to say at summary judgment that that's a viable legal theory.
I agree, and we have an expert who we hired, and his name is Bruce Henry, and he issued a report in the federal court as required, and that's what his report says.
You're down to 152 in your rebuttal.
I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, and I thank you very much, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, my name is Matthew Lee, and I represent the appellees Linda Reagan-Hart and her law firm. As an initial matter, I'd like to let the members of the Court know that Ms. Reagan-Hart died suddenly and unexpectedly in October of last year during the pendency of this lawsuit. Prior to that time, as has been alluded to, she was a long-standing member of the bar of this court, focusing her practice on bankruptcy law. If I could answer Justice Powell's question of my colleague, the joint appendix at pages 111 through 126 contain Judge Kenney's findings of fact and conclusions of law. If I could segue into those findings of fact and those conclusions of law are binding upon Dr. Lavold in this case.
Isn't the theory, though, that had he received sound legal advice, he would have taken steps that would have obviated the court making those findings?
Yes, Your Honor. That's their theory, but it's erroneous.
Okay.
First of all, as far as collateral estoppel goes, I'm sorry that the party's briefs did not correctly articulate this. The federal judge, the federal court issued an order. And as the U.S. Supreme Court has said in Semtec v. Lockheed in 2001, even state courts construing the preclusive effects of federal court orders must apply to federal common law, not their own race judicata principles.
Can I interrupt you and
yes, sir.
Draw you back to Justice McCullough's question? Let's say it's erroneous. Let's just hypothesize that that theory of legal liability on a summary judgment motion would die. That if that, I don't see that as the issue. I see the issue we're looking at is simply standing.
Yes, sir.
Can you make this? Can you go into court and say anything about this? And the answer is no. If it's pre-petitional petition, yes. If it's truly post-petition, they come up with a post-petition theory, and you quite ably pick apart all of their post-petition theories, and you may be easily successful at some later date. But is that really before us? Do we really get into those things and say, well, maybe it is post-petition, but it's a loser argument? Is that what you're asking? I know you're not asking us to do that, but is that what we're being led to do?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe so. The complaint, which is the operative pleading in this case right now, alleges pre- and post-petition breaches of the standard of care, all of which they allege resulted in the same harm, ultimately the denial of the discharge under Section 727. So those are the facts that are before this court. When we moved to dismiss in front of Judge Trenga from the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia, they pivoted and said, well, we're giving up on what we know are pre-petition breaches, and we're going to stipulate that the loss of equity in the home, which is a damage, we're going to stipulate we're not going to seek that in a jury trial. Well, Judge Trenga rightly concluded, you don't get to put blinders on the court. We look at the facts that are alleged, and we also look at the facts that are in Judge Kenney's order, and I can tell you that the reason that Judge Kenney, it's right there in the order, Judge Kenney denied him a discharge for three reasons. A, he transferred his residence to he and his wife via deed of gift on January 7, 2013. B, he filed his bankruptcy petition for Chapter 7 on July 22, 2013. C, after a three-day bench trial, Judge Kenney concluded that that transfer exhibited every single badge of fraud except for one. And thus he concluded because the transfer was made within 1 year, it was made with the intent to delay, hinder, or defraud his creditors. Now the fallacy of their position is, well, we agree, and it's replete throughout the Georgia appendix, they agree that a cause of action accrued pre-petition. And under Shipman, as Your Honor pointed out, Justice Kelsey, all the damages that flow once that breach and once the cause of action accrues pre-petition, just because the denial of discharge happened 2 years later, doesn't mean it's not part of that cause of action. It flows.
May I interrupt you there as well?
Yes, sir.
There's a very curious overlay, and that's the sufficiently rooted doctrine
of
bankruptcy law, which is the standing issue. And both of you all have developed it, but I wonder if this is a fair synthesis of it. That's a question of federal law, not a question of state cause of action law. It's not a question of state accrual laws. It's a question of federal law, federal standing in the operation of the transfer of the debtors' estates and the rights to the estates. Under your argument, the sufficiently rooted doctrine actually goes more broadly in scope than our ubiquitous jurisprudence on defining new torts post-original tort for purposes of splitting the cause of action. Which, all this helps you if what my hypothesis is true, because the sufficiently rooted doctrine is looser than the cause of action scope doctrine under state tort law. Do you get what I'm driving at?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, and I agree with you. It gives some flexibility to courts to go ahead and say, even though there was some post-petition action, we're going to say that this cause of action became...
It's close enough.
It's close enough. It's sufficiently rooted in pre-petition action, which clearly this was. And we put that argument in because we think it applies. But let me be clear here. I think this case is on all fours with this court's decision in Shipman v. Krupp. He filed his petition. The moment he filed his petition, he suffered a legal injury. They admit this in the joint appendix at 183. They admit this in their brief on page 28 and in page 3 of their reply brief. They admit that a cause of action accrued for legal malpractice because he lost the equity in his home. But why did he lose the equity in his home? Because under Section 548, the trustee, the bankruptcy trustee, not the U.S. trustee, the bankruptcy trustee is entitled to avoid the transfer because it was fraudulent. And it was made within 2 years of the filing date of the petition. So for the very same reasons that the U.S. trustee ultimately obtained the denial, wholesale denial of discharge under 727, so too did the bankruptcy trustee have the ability to avoid, and that's why he had to pay the equity. So even as they concede, they suffered the damage under 727 accrued at the time the petition was filed, because at that point in time, the Rubicon was crossed. The die was cast. But for the transfer in January of 2013 and its temporal proximity to the filing of the Chapter 7 petition, Judge Kenney could not have denied him a discharge. And everything after that, that they say we could have done to correct the mistake, those are just that's not subsequent breaches. They're saying, well, you didn't mitigate it. Okay, but the only reason that Judge Kenney could deny the discharge under that statute is because of the temporal proximity to the fraudulent transfer.
So in the summary form, there may be new tortious acts, but there's no new tortious damages.
That, and because of Shipman, the damages...
We need both. We need new tortious acts and new tortious damages in order to have a new tort.
Correct. And what I think I hear them saying, and they haven't made this argument, they didn't make it below, and they didn't explicitly make it here before this court, is that what I think they're saying is that my client, Ms. Regenhardt's post-petition breaches are somehow supervening, intervening, proximate cause of the denial of discharge. But we know that can't be true.
Well, actually, though, look at the distinctions that they make in the Shipman case in their reply brief. Could you address the fourth one? I mean,
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Which one?
In the appellant's reply brief, you say Shipman controls. He says Shipman can be distinguished in four ways.
Okay.
The fourth one is the most curious to me. So he says in that the trustees were not required to bring adversary proceedings or seek the denial of discharge as a matter of law. Both were discretionary and neither were foregone conclusions.
Well, he says
that somehow makes a distinction.
It does not, Your Honor, respectfully. It's rank speculation.
But you know, this boils down to something very simple. The argument is, look, if you'd have told me this before filing the bank's petition, that I could get caught and I could get in trouble, no, I don't think I'd have done this. And if I hadn't have done it, no one would have got me in trouble. But once you crossed that bridge and got in there, you made it a lot worse by doing dumb things that put me in the position where I'm certainly going to get in trouble now, and then he got in trouble.
I agree with the first part of that. It is that the case, as Your Honor suggested to my co-counsel, is you didn't help me get away with it. You didn't give me proper legal advice to get away with what we now know has been adjudicated a fraudulent transfer. Not just Judge Kenney. It went up to the district court and Judge Lee. He affirmed. It went up to the Fourth Circuit. They affirmed. So
I'm not 100% sure why you sort of back away from the sufficiently rooted doctrine, because that's a federal idea. It would not complicate our cause of action law, which is a delicate subject anyway. It's a hard subject to get your hands around in Virginia. It's a hard subject in every state.
I apologize if I thought I was back. If I gave the impression that I was backing away from that argument. I think the argument clearly is viable. The Fourth Circuit continues to recognize that causes of action or property that have pre-petition roots that may have also post-petition elements to it become property of the bankruptcy estate. The reason I focus on Shipman and the accrual of a cause of action is because bankruptcy law determines what property becomes assets of the estate. But state law determines what the nature of those assets are. In this particular case, it would be a cause of action. So from our standpoint, the cause of action is but one cause of action that resulted or accrued when the bankruptcy petition was filed. The harm was filing the petition within 6 months of the fraudulent transfer, from which all the damages flow. And just as in Shipman, the Shipmans suffered a legal injury, as Justice Agee said at the time, because they lost control of their assets to the bankruptcy trustee. That's what forced them to pay the equity in their home, to buy back their home from the bankruptcy trustee. So too here. He had to buy back the equity in his home for about $100,000+. And in that regard, it matters not that he did so post-petition. Just the Shipman, again, the unanimous decision, rejected that refusal. And it matters not that the bankruptcy court adjudication that the transfer or the trust was revocable occurred post-petition. The legal injury occurred at the point the petition was filed.
What do you make of his argument, and I'm probably going to paraphrase it badly, that the filing of the bad petition caused him to have to surrender the house or to buy it back, but then the bad post-filing advice that it is the point beyond which you can no longer correct the problem is an argument that is made.
I read that and I was a little bit baffled by it. There's no Virginia precedent whatsoever to support that a cause of action only accrues when there's nothing left to do to avoid the harm. Quite the contrary. As we know from Shipman, the cause of action accrues when injury occurs, no matter how slight, and whether the bulk of the damages occur some years later. So they concede that injury occurred. They must concede it because Shipman occurred. That injury occurred, as I've said, for the exact same reasons, or arose out of the exact same factual predicate for which they were denied later, for which later he was denied his discharge, the fraudulent transfer and the proxy of the petition. Did that answer Your Honor's question?
You did, thank you.
Are there any further questions, Your Honor?
Just one thing that puzzled me. I mean, in some my limited experience on the subject, you know, we have situations where, you know, a person at bankruptcy's door maybe has an auto accident or, you know, some tort like that, and either through the neglect of the bankruptcy attorney or through, you know, the person strategically trying to keep his creditors' hands off of this, you know, say, auto accident, tort, or whatever, there's no disclosure made on the schedule. Is the expectation that in this peculiar scenario, the bankruptcy attorney would disclose their own negligence in the petition, and then that puts it in play for the trustee and so on? I mean, it's just a bizarre background fact to the case. It's not central to resolution of anything, but it seems rather peculiar.
Yes, Your Honor. It would, in order for the asset that wasn't scheduled, in other words, the cause of action that you say accrued when the petition was filed and the petition got a personal injury claim, which I believe was dealt with in the Coker decision earlier, it would need to be scheduled. It would need to be identified and scheduled. The trustee needs to know about it. It has never been scheduled in this case.
Right, so then we're expecting the bankruptcy attorney who's doing the bankruptcy and preparing the schedules to say on the schedule,
he's got another asset, his lawsuit against me.
Yeah. It's my, you know, and it's going to be worth X amount when I get sued. And
ideally, Your Honors, that would be the case. The attorney should self-report, and it should be a but I don't think...
What you do at that point is recuse yourself or whatever.
That's exactly what happened here. They hired a new attorney to come in and handle the adversary proceedings by the trustees. Yeah. So I thank you, Your Honor, for your attention.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think Your Honor hit the nail on the head with your last question, which was, is Mr. Lappold supposed to put on his bankruptcy petition that I have a claim for denial of discharge against my bankruptcy lawyer? He could. That's essentially what Mr. Lee's argument is in this case, is that he should have scheduled a denial of discharge argument because that was the claim. And he couldn't file a claim for denial of discharge as of the day that he filed for bankruptcy. That's our position.
How about legal malpractice just in giving bad advice and filing bankruptcy? I mean, it seems like to me in this particular instance, Mr. Labgo could have not known. I mean, he just got married. He puts his, you know, changes the ownership of his house, the tenants by the entirety. It seems like to me when you go to the bankruptcy attorney, he says, you can't file for bankruptcy because you've just transferred your house. And this is what's going to happen.
Well, that is a whole different scenario, and that ties into the Shipman issue. And we respectfully believe that Shipman simply doesn't apply to this case. All Shipman does is stand for the uncontroversial position that you have to have damage to sue for malpractice. In Shipman, it was agreed that the only action was when it was filed because the trust became irrevocable at that time. That's consistent with the legal malpractice cases arising out of divorces and wills in Virginia. So the divorce case, not until the divorce is filed. In the will case, when the testator dies. In a denial of discharge case, when the discharge is denied. And that's our position in this particular case. And now I want to address sufficiently rooted. It's our position sufficiently rooted doesn't apply because it's been perceived. Because Section 541 is after. Even if it was, you have to have the damage for sufficiently rooted long before you file for bankruptcy. The Siebel case, the right to the tax refund occurred before the bankruptcy was filed. And so that's why sufficiently rooted does not apply in this particular case. I believe I'm out of time, Your Honor.
All right. The court will be in recess until 10 minutes after 11.
All right.